Blog Talk Radio.
Coming up on HUR Voices Sirius XM, Channel 141. I'm Javon Harley. Make sure you check out our website. It's thetravelingeye.com. There you can friend and like us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. And we want you to join the Travel Club.
And now, Javon's Travel Minute.
Long flights can be grueling, but there are ways you can make it less brutal. Make yourself as comfortable as possible. Dress in stretch fabrics and thin layers, or bring a light jogging suit to change into. Bring a neck pillow. I like the ones with microbeads. They're much softer. Come out of your shoes and put on travel socks, the ones with a sole to protect your feet against germs. Stay hydrated, internally and externally. Drink plenty of water, starting days before your trip and during the flight. And don't forget about your skin. Moisturize with a night cream and bring along a hydrating facial spray and chapstick. Earplugs, earbuds, or noise-canceling headphones will keep out unwanted noise that may otherwise annoy you or keep you awake. This is Javon, and that was your Travel Minute. I am proud. Proud to be black. Proud to be an African American woman. I'm proud of my parents. I'm proud of my grandparents and all of those who came before me. That's why today I'm making virtual stops at some national historic landmarks that pay homage to African-American heroes and sheroes. These incredible individuals made major contributions in America while facing tremendous strife and tragedy. Through it all, they persevered and gave of themselves selflessly. My first stop is in Tuskegee, Alabama, at Tuskegee Institute. This university was part of the expansion of education for blacks in the South following the Civil War. A historical black college, it first opened in 1881 as Talladega College, with a student body of 30 and one teacher, Booker T. Washington. Booker T. Washington arrived in Alabama and started building the Tuskegee Institute. He recruited the best and the brightest to come and teach, including George Washington Carver, who arrived in 1896. Carver's innovations in agriculture, especially peanuts, expanded Tuskegee's standing throughout the country. The George Washington Carver Museum is part of this historic site. It was originally constructed in 1915 as the campus laundry. In 1941, it was dedicated as the museum. There's also the Oaks, which was the family home of Booker T. Washington. The house was built in 1899 by students and faculty using bricks made by students. Tuskegee also had a well-respected aeronautical engineering program. Because of this, the United States military selected Tuskegee Institute as a place to train African-American pilots for the war effort. Their rigorous training molded over 1,000 pilots into one of the most highly respected U.S. fighter groups of World War II. These pilots are known as the Tuskegee Airmen. As part of the National Park Service, you can get information for visiting Tuskegee Institute at nps.gov. Heading north, we discover the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad Byway in Dorchester and Caroline Counties on Maryland's eastern shore. This site preserves and recounts the life story of Harriet Tubman and her courageous acts. She's one of the most lauded figures in American history. Born into slavery in Maryland around 1822, Tubman successfully escaped to Philadelphia in 1849. Once free, she became an operator of the Underground Railroad, a secret network of people, places, and routes that provided shelter and assistance for escaping slaves. She boldly returned south at least 13 times to rescue family and friends, guiding them safely to freedom. By 1860, Tubman had earned the nickname Moses for selflessly liberating the enslaved. In 2013, President Obama proclaimed this site a national monument. Its landscape is deeply associated with Tubman and the Underground Railroad. It includes the Jacobs Jackson home site, one of the first houses along the Underground Railroad, Bethel Church, where African Americans worshipped at that time, Stewart's Canal, which provided an escape route for slaves, and the James Cook home site, where Tubman herself was hired out as a child. With more than 30 sites along a 125-mile scenic road, including the newly designated Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad National Historical Park, a self-guided driving tour shows you the places where Tubman grew up, worshipped, labored, and led others to freedom. For information and to map your own course of the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad Byway, visit HarrietTubmanByway.org.
I'm in charge of the Underground Railroad. Oh, oh, yeah. My name is Harriet. I'm in charge of the Underground Railroad. Oh, yeah. Don't be afraid. Come on in, have a seat, drop your load on the Underground Railroad. Oh, yeah. Don't be afraid. Come on in, have a seat, drop your load.
In Great Barrington, Massachusetts, is the W.E.B. Du Bois National Historic Site. W.E.B. Du Bois was one of the most influential, provocative, and literary voices in the 20th century. He was an American historian, civil rights activist, and author. William Edward Burghardt Du Bois' story begins on his birthday, February 23, 1868, in the small rural town of Great Barrington, Massachusetts. The life and values of rural New England and its small African-American community, some of whose members fought in the famous all-black 54th Massachusetts Volunteer Infantry Regiment, shaped Du Bois' early years and his ideas about democracy, education, and family. In 1885, Du Bois left home for Fisk University, studied in Berlin, and became the first African-American to graduate with a Ph.D. from Harvard University in 1895. By age 35, Du Bois had published The Suppression of the African Slave Trade, The Philadelphia Negro, and The Souls of Black Folk, his seminal work. He was a founder and leader of the Niagara Movement, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, and the Pan-African Congresses. Du Bois served as the editor of the Crisis magazine for 24 years and lectured throughout the world well into his later life. His prominence and ideas were threatening to some, and in the 1950s, during the McCarthy era, he was falsely accused of being an agent of a foreign power and later exonerated of all charges. At the invitation of the president of Ghana, Du Bois moved to Ghana at the age of 93 to undertake writing the Encyclopedia Africana. A self-guided interpretive trail highlights Du Bois' journey from Great Barrington to the world stage and presents information from ongoing archaeological excavations, as well as the home site dedication in 1969. There's also the W.E.B. Du Bois in Great Barrington walking and motor tour that takes you to 17 sites revealing the townspeople and places that were important to Du Bois. You can download the guide at DuBoisNHS.org. Now, why don't we head west to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas? There we find the Buffalo Soldier Memorial Park.
Oh,
In 1866, the U.S. Congress authorized the formation of several black regiments known as the United States Colored Troops, composed of black soldiers led by white officers. This reorganization formed two regiments of black cavalry and four regiments of black infantry. These men were the first black soldiers to serve during peacetime. These unsung heroes were fathers, sons, brothers, and husbands. They were former slaves, Civil War veterans, and brave patriots. Just as their white colleagues, these men came from all walks of life. But the biggest question about the Buffalo Soldiers is why the name? Some say it's because of the heavy buffalo robes the soldiers wore on winter campaigns. Others say that when the American bison was wounded or cornered, it fought ferociously, displaying uncommon stamina and courage, identical to the black man in battle. Whatever the reason for the name, the Buffalo Soldier, armed with a .45-70 caliber rifle, a Colt .45 caliber pistol, and a saber, has gone down in American history as one of the proudest and toughest soldiers of all. On July 25, 1992, the Buffalo Soldier Monument was dedicated by General Colin Powell, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who was the first African American to serve in that capacity. The memorial consists of the Buffalo Soldier Monument, Circle of Fists, and Walkway of Units, which commemorate the significant firsts in the history of African-American soldiers and units in the United States Army. You can get more information on the Buffalo Soldier Memorial Park at garrison.leavenworth.army.mil.
Once upon this planet Earth, lived a man.
Now I have to bring it home to my hometown, Washington, D.C., and the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial, the first on the National Mall devoted not to a president or a war hero. Martin Luther King Jr. was born Michael Luther King Jr. on January 15, 1929, in Atlanta, Georgia. He attended Morehouse College, earning a B.A. in sociology. He later graduated Crozer Theological Seminary and Boston University with a degree in systematic theology. In 1954, he took a pastorate in Montgomery, Alabama, where he joined the leadership of the local NAACP, the Montgomery Improvement Association, and served in the creation of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. He was the architect of nonviolence as he led the civil rights movement. In 1963, he delivered the historic I Have a Dream speech at the March on Washington. In 1964, he received the Nobel Peace Prize, and unfortunately, our nation suffered a great loss in 1968 when he was assassinated. But in 1996, Congress authorized the Alpha Phi Alpha, Dr. King's fraternity, to establish a memorial to him in Washington, D.C. 15 years later, the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial was open to the public. The original opening and dedication was to take place in August of 2011, but due to Hurricane Irene, the events were postponed until October 16th, the 16th anniversary of the Million Man March. President Obama, the 44th president and first African-American president, spoke at the dedication in celebration of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s return to the National Mall.
An earthquake and a hurricane may have delayed this day, but this is a day that would not be denied. For this day, we celebrate Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s return to the National Mall. A black preacher, no official rank or title, who somehow gave voice to our deepest dreams and our most lasting ideals. A man who stirred our conscience and thereby helped make our union more perfect. I raise all this because nearly 50 years after the March on Washington, our work, Dr. King's work, is not yet complete. When confronting disappointment, Dr. King refused to accept what he called the isness of today. He kept pushing towards the oughtness of tomorrow.
And just as Mahalia Jackson sang Precious Lord at the March on Washington, so did Aretha Franklin, the Queen of Soul, at the dedication. Each memorial component holds its own unique significance, a wall of quotes representing Dr. King's ideals of hope, democracy, and love, flanking the mountain of despair and encircling the stone of hope. Nature is also an important part of the memorial design. The cherry trees are positioned to bloom in a particular spot so as to cause the effect of Martin Luther King Jr. gazing upon them. Even the address for the memorial has special significance. 1964 Independence Avenue. This street address is in reference to the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Visit nps.gov/MLKM for more information.
We face difficulties of today and tomorrow. I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up, live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the people injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, to be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama, with its vicious racist, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, one day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. One day every valley shall be exalted. Every hill and mountain shall be made low. The rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. This is the faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. This will be the day when all of God's children be able to sing with new meaning, my country tears of thee. Sweet land of liberty of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrims cry. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. So let freedom ring. From the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire, let freedom ring. From the mighty mountains of New York, let freedom ring. From the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania, Let freedom ring from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. Let freedom ring from the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
When we come back, we're going to answer some very important questions about takeoffs and landings. I'm Javon Harley for The Traveling Eye on HUR Voices, Sirius XM, Channel 141. Did you know that there are several national historic landmarks that are endangered? The Malcolm X House, the modest home in Boston, Massachusetts, is the last known surviving childhood home of Malcolm X. The home has been largely vacant for over 30 years, and it's owned by the son of Ella Little Collins, Malcolm X's half-sister. A partnership between Historic Boston and the National Trust for Historic Preservation is planning to develop the property into graduate study housing for students of African American history, social justice, or civil rights. The Malcolm X House site is located at 3448 Pinckney Street in Omaha, Nebraska. The home was torn down prior to 1970. Medgar Evers Home. This Jackson, Mississippi house was home to civil rights leader Medgar Evers and his family. Evers was assassinated in the driveway of the house on June 12, 1963. Legislation to designate the house as a unit of the National Park Service has been introduced, but has thus far not made it out of the committee. The Emmett Till site. Bryant's Grocery in Money, Mississippi is the site where 14-year-old Emmett Till was brutally murdered in 1955. Till was killed for supposedly whistling at a white woman who worked at the market. Bryant's Grocery is now the first stop on the Mississippi Freedom Trail. Gore Hall. Historically black colleges and universities have provided higher education to minority students for more than 175 years. These campuses serve as an important meeting place during the civil rights movement. The Pillerman and Gore Residence Halls at West Virginia State University, built in the early 1900s, are currently facing demolition. Both sites are eligible for listing on the National Register of Historic Places. Lastly, the Paul Robeson House. Located in West Philadelphia, this home was the last residence in the African-American scholar, athlete, performer, and activist Paul Robeson. Since 1994, the home has been owned and operated by the West Philadelphia Cultural Alliance. The Robeson House promotes history and culture by producing exhibits, lectures, and concerts. The Pennsylvania Historical Museum Commission and the White House officially recognized the museum as a National Historic Preservation Site. The West Philadelphia Culture Alliance is currently fundraising to restore and endow the Robeson House. Why don't you take a look into some of these endangered sites? We don't want to lose them. We want them to remain part of our history for the generations to come. Welcome back to The Traveling Eye on HUR Voices, Sirius XM, Channel 141. I'm Javon Harley. Make sure you check out our website. It's thetravelingeye.com. There you can friend and like us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. And we want you to join the Travel Club. So the question of the day is, why do the airlines dim the lights at takeoff or turn them on for landing, especially for overnight flights? or they ask you to raise the window shade. Have you ever noticed it? Do you know why? We took to the streets to see if you really knew the answer to that question, or if you even noticed that this was something that the airlines did. Here's what a few people thought about the question.
Raise the shade? No, I never noticed it. That's not true.
Yes, I noticed that the lights are dim on takeoff so that the captain can see better at takeoff time. There's not a reflection from the airplane, the cabin, so that they can see each area for security reasons and different people taking off and landing.
So, yeah, I have noticed that the lights are pretty dim when you take off the plane. I think that that's just because some people are scared of planes, they're scared of flying.
Say what?
Well, I'm glad I'm answering the question for you today. Adjusting the lights and window shades are part of that preparation process, as is returning your seat back to the upright position, putting your tray table up, clearing the aisle in front of your seat, and putting your seat belt on. These are standard safety measures during takeoff and landing because it's the most critical moments of every flight. But what specific purpose do they serve? Both are very simple answers. The dim lighting is done to allow passengers and crew members' eyes to adjust more quickly during an emergency evacuation. Imagine being in a dark room and then quickly turning on the light, or being in a bright room and turning off the light. It takes your eyes some time to adjust to the difference. You're now in an unfamiliar environment with obstacles. You won't have time to wait a minute before that happens, especially when the critical time or the evacuation period is supposed to be about 90 seconds. Now, passengers are asked to open window shades before takeoffs and landings. This is to prepare in case of emergency as well. If the captain needs to make an emergency landing or evacuation, raising the window shade simply allows the cabin crew and you, the passengers, to see outside. You can assess the environment and its conditions. Is there fire? Is there water or an obstruction? In case of sudden emergencies, every second counts. As I said before, the overall plan is based on a 90-second evacuation plan. There's no time to do this after an accident or emergency. So during daytime, opening window shades and putting cabin lights to full makes the eyes used to the sunlight. So if something goes wrong and passengers need to be evacuated, there will not be a sudden change in light contrast. So now you are in the know. I came across this blog written by Anne Foss, a traveler, writer, and a storyteller, titled 10 Things I Learned Traveling as a Couple. Now, this article resonated with me because I'm married, and I've been married for quite some time. All very good anecdotes. I've also noticed when I'm traveling with my groups how other couples travel together, some successfully, some not so successfully, and we see different things unfold as the trip goes on. So here we go. I'm going to go through these 10 things I learned traveling as a couple. Find the humor in every situation. This is so, so true, and it's very important. And I think it's whether you are traveling as a couple or anytime you travel, you need to have a sense of humor because things will happen. Things like lost in translation, things that will infuriate you, things that make no sense, things that make you feel uncomfortable. But the bottom line is, if you are lighthearted about these things, if you're flexible about them, and if you can find the humor in them, it'll make things that much better. And if you're a new couple traveling together, make sure that you understand something embarrassing is going to happen to one of you during that trip. So make sure it's somebody that you can look in the face when you get back. Bring snacks. This is very, very important because a lot of times we get grumpy. You know that commercial that says that you're not yourself? You need something? Well, it's the same thing here. Making sure that you're comfortable and making sure that you're taken care of is very important. You can get very grumpy if you're not, especially something like a road trip, much more comfortable for both of you, and you're not going to be at each other. Be generous with affection. Being in tune with your partner's needs is very important. What you'll find when you're traveling, you're going to be each other's main emotional resource. And you're going to be that shoulder for someone to lean on. And then you're going to need a shoulder to lean on. And so during those times, you want to be generous, not only, I think, with your affection, but with your empathy. And that will help travel be less stressful for both of you. Number four, practice and practice. Personal space and time alone are a luxury while traveling. Well, I can tell you one thing, and you have said a mouthful there. Personal space, and understanding that when you're traveling with a couple, or even if you're traveling with girlfriends or guy friends, when you want to spend time together, when you want to spend time apart. Just because you're going as a couple doesn't mean you have to spend every single moment together. And sometimes people don't understand that. I find it's very useful if you have that conversation ahead of time so that each of you know those expectations going in. Because if not, you get there and you have one person who wants to spend all time together and you have another person who needs that occasional space, then someone's feelings will get hurt. So that's a conversation you want to have ahead of time. You want to make sure you understand that you both should have personal space, time alone, and then there are those times when you come together and you really want to be together. And so, as I said, just have that conversation ahead of time so that you don't have any misunderstandings when you're on the trip. Forgive quickly. Now, I cannot stress this one enough. The last thing you want to do is have someone sulking for an entire trip. Something happens. Okay, it happens. Deal with it. Address it. Let your emotions out. But get over it. Forgive. Remember, forgiveness is as much for you as it is the other person. You don't want to be that person that's walking around with your lips poked out and with your shoulders raised. So whatever it is, get over it. Have a good time. Focus on the destination. Focus on the matter at hand. Vacation or a trip is not the time to sulk. Number six, decide beforehand how to split travel logistics. This, too, is very important for two reasons for me. One is, one person doesn't want to shoulder all of the responsibility for the vacation for two people, because then you're thinking, what if I've planned everything and there's nothing that this other person wants to do? The other thing is that when everybody's involved, they're more invested in the vacation itself. They don't feel like a tag-along, or they don't feel like they have to wait for your instructions on what to do. So even if they're reluctant at first, say, no, I'm going to handle the flights. You can handle the hotel accommodations. Keep track of your expenses, especially if you're working with two different budgets. That's something else you want to discuss ahead of time. So if you have champagne wishes and caviar dreams and the other person is the frugal one, then there's going to be some angst. And while you're there, you want to make sure you're keeping track of your expenses. Stay within your budget. Just make sure that you're on everyone's budget, or that you're mixing things up. Or maybe if that's the great divide, then those are the particular things that you do on your own. Number eight, seek time alone. Well, that kind of goes with the patience, and with that personal space and what other people feel that they may have. Time alone is very, very important. It allows you to rejuvenate. It allows you to want to come back to that person. Remember to reach out to other people. When traveling as a couple, you slip into a comfort zone of only talking to each other. And I always like to go out maybe to a bar or to a nightclub, or even if I'm at a restaurant, put myself in a more social environment so that we can include other people. 24/7 for 7 to 14 days, only talking to one person, it can wear on you a little bit. But you lean on each other for other things. It'll just make that one-on-one time that much more special. Lastly, savor the moments. There are going to be times when circumstances do not allow us to travel. And so you want to have those memorable occasions. And when you find yourself in them, sometimes they're planned, sometimes they're not planned. You want to savor those moments. One moment, actually I had a couple of moments on our last trip to Hawaii. One is the restaurant experiences that we had. We really searched for nice restaurants for foodies. Not necessarily expensive. We went to one that was expensive at Morimoto's in Honolulu. But we tried different types of restaurants, different types of cuisines. We did food trucks. We did strip mall restaurants that turned out to be excellent. So we mixed it up. But those moments I savored and I thought were fantastic. They were quiet times and we discussed the food and we were enjoying the cuisine and we talked about the different ingredients and we took our time and had a leisurely dinner. We didn't rush through it, so we just kind of savored those moments. And the last one was swimming with the manta rays. That was such a fantastic experience. It was one that we hadn't planned on, didn't know anything about, but the concierge at the hotel recommended it, and I'm so glad we did it. It was a nighttime snorkel. It was mysterious. It was beautiful. There were just so many wonderful things about it. And then after the fact, when we got back, after we've completed the adventure, we got back to our hotel room, we just looked at each other and said, you know what? That was an awesome experience. So thank you, Ann Foss, for writing this blog. It really did give me inspiration. And I hope that I've given you some inspiration and some tips on traveling as a couple and making sure that you do so successfully. You've been listening to The Traveling Eye with me, Javon Harley. I'll be here next week at the same time with more travel news, tips, and topics. Connect with The Traveling Eye anytime and join the Travel Club at thetravelingeye.com. Special thanks to studio producer Brittany Riddle, video producer Howard Little, Hi, this is Javon Harley, your travel pro and the host of The Traveling Eye, with a countdown to Ghana. Ghana is a great place to start in Africa, known as Africa for Beginners. Ghana is a great destination for getting acquainted with this diverse continent. And here are several reasons why. Ghana has friendly people, traditional Ghanaian hospitality, culture, history, sea, sun, and sand. But the top reason to visit Ghana is to join me, The Traveling Eye, and Advantage International to Ghana to see it all firsthand. So block off September and stay tuned for the complete package with all the details coming soon.